Welcome to the Black House. We're usually on a radio station Saturday afternoons, but today we're online today. We've got an incredibly special guest today. My guest today is a legendary musician, a political activist, and a Pan-Africanist, the youngest son of Afrobeat pioneer Phil Ekuti. He joined his father's band Egypt 80 before the age of 12 and became the band's leader after his father's death in 1997. You're scheduled to do two performances in New Zealand, one in Auckland, one in Wellington at the end of May. So I just wanted to give a massive, massive shout out to Sean Kuti. How are you doing, man?
Thanks for having me on your show, bro.
The advice that I gave you was kind of quite a formal sort of, or kind of what structure to the bio. I want to turn it over to you. Like, how would you define yourself as an artist, as an activist?
I don't even think I'm an activist per se. I see myself as a revolutionary artist. We are not looking for reforms and allowances within the existing status quo. Music, my ideology, which feeds the inspiration of my music, seeks a new way, you know. I necessarily do not know how everything should look like, the contributions that I can add to that new world. So I seek for people to begin to value those things. I always say, I don't know what thing to do, but I know say something they do me. This means I might not know what to do, but I know something is happening to me. You know, I cannot say something is doing me in English, but you know, you can use that in pidgin English.
No, I think it's interesting. It sort of speaks to that sort of trend of sort of seeing that need for big scale kind of systemic sort of change.
Yeah, I don't think change, the big changes happen in a vacuum. You know, I think those big leaps that we take as African people, you know, be it the reclamation of our humanity and the fight for the ending of slavery. This was from 1804, as soon as Toussaint liberated Haiti, we were free. Colonialism, as soon as Sankara liberated Ghana in 57, we were basically free. You know, and the civil rights movement also, which came out, which was inspired out of that movement for Africans to begin to decide their own political destiny. Mm-hmm. You know, I know we are taking a lot of time to use this hard-fought opportunity properly, to the extent that probably we are losing some of the gains.
Yeah.
But, you know, we have to also understand that we're people that were locked out of the game for a long time.
Mm.
Never invited in. You know, every step we are taking, yeah, it's true, you know, we are children of sacrifice. You know, everything that we can do as black people, as African people all over the world, was paid for with blood. There was no time. People said, okay, it's cool, you know, you are humans now. You know, we couldn't be doctors, we couldn't be lawyers, we couldn't vote, we couldn't go to school. Every step, you know, to integrate into this system. You know, and I don't think the system has respected that, and in return, seen us as capable equals to participate. You know, so this is why I do not believe in it, you know, as an African. And I understand that we must find a way, and we need the political and social consciousness to be able to do that. And that is what is slowly coming to the fore, because a lot of Africans all over the world now see that, no, this is not right. Yeah.
And I think it's a good point you make, obviously from Haiti, and like how those kind of struggles cascade, or how those kind of those changes sort of cascade from that moment. Because one of the things that came up in so my research was in Rastafari in New Zealand, because New Zealand has not a huge Rasta population, but has a Rasta community here. And one of the kind of things, there was a book I read called Black Pacific, and it was tracing the kind of lineage or the history of African rights struggles into indigenous rights struggles in New Zealand. So I thought that was part of the reason why Rasta kind of took root here, was that obviously artists like Marley speaking to the same sort of rights struggles that Maori and Pacific people were talking to here. But also there was a kind of deeper thing where even during, you know, the 19th century, in the process of colonization of New Zealand, Maori leaders were talking about Toussaint Louverture. Like, they were talking about Haiti. They were talking about, and there was that, there was a kind of lineage that kind of tracked from those struggles, kind of, to kind of expand on those struggles.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. That's the point, because all over the world, I think indigenous people have found inspiration in each other's experiences. You know, if we look back to the most recent history of our liberation movements from the 50s to the 70s, you find a lot of cooperation and coordination, you know, between the so-called non-aligned nations, you know. And with the auspices of the Cold War as an excuse, the Europeans, you know, were able to infiltrate and dismantle a lot of our institutions and our nations and institutions, you know. So we have not rekindled that political understanding of rebuilding our political and economic independence as African. I think that is the great task. You know, one of the great tasks I think this generation has in front of it, as this new African generation.
Flows into my kind of next question, I guess, talking about this kind of new era I kind of see of Pan-Africanism and tensions sort of at play that I kind of would be keen to hear your kind of thoughts on, where like, when one of my interviews, I spoke to someone and they said they were like trying to work out how can we build African unity, how can we build, pardon me, things like the internet, we should be able to build some of the strongest networks of African unity. Like, you look at Marcus Garvey and his network was built with print newspaper, or like kind of largest kind of Pan-African sort of networks was built on print newspaper, print media. And it's that sort of question of how do we leverage those same tools, or how do we leverage the tools that we have today, formulate kind of our own stronger or even more well-connected African unity?
Well, I think those of us that are Pan-Africanists, you know, need to probably put more effort into our own coordination and networking to find each other better, and tools that we can use in each other's vicinity and community to enhance our struggle. You know, one of the great disadvantages is that a lot of us wealthy people in quotes, do not see themselves as Pan-Africanists. They are more Afro-capitalists. You know, the black excellence, you know, mantra. So the work that we have to do right now is more about organizing in our own local communities. Let's look at this as trying to build a smoke signal so big that other Pan-Africanists can see. That is the main goal, I think. Because the rhetoric of Pan-Africanism is hijacked by so many people. I mean, Pan-Africanism is used to justify military takeovers now in Africa. Pan-Africanism is used to justify all sorts of exploitation of women, of children, of working people. You know, Pan-Africanism is used to justify homophobia in the African communities, you know. So how do we reclaim the true narrative, you know, of African liberation? You know, how do we support the movement? How do we bring our own star voices? How do we make them big? How do we project the voices that represent us? All these things so that we can influence. How are we creating circles of understanding, of knowledge for younger people? You know, this can only be done through organizing. It's not an individual effort. So I think we just need to put more effort globally into organizing for our vision.
I think, that's because I know for the Black House, that's kind of been our kind of goal, has been to really kind of document, and I guess kind of the history, but also and capture this, and both the history, but also the present stories of African people in New Zealand, because it's one of these things where there's kind of three sort of migration waves. So there's like the late kind of 19th, kind of early 20th century, which is primarily through the naval, like shipping trade, and that sort of thing. There's a flow of kind of usually Caribbean and African American kind of people coming to New Zealand. Then in the 60s, there was, I think it was called the Special Commonwealth African Academic Program. So that was kind of a wave of African PhD students and scholars studying at New Zealand universities. And then kind of the third wave is kind of from the 80s and 90s onwards, there's kind of been a big wave of both refugees, but also former refugees, but also migrants as well. And I think that's been the big question that we've been trying to answer, is what does it mean to be an African in New Zealand? Like, what does it mean to be an Afro? We call ourselves Afro Kiwis, because I think that's that sort of thing. If we're trying to kind of work out what that identity is and kind of capture those unique experiences.
I think Nkrumah said it best when he said, I'm not African because I was born in Africa. I am African because Africa was born in me. And I think this is why it's important that we study our ancestors. I think many of the things that many of us think are not being done, work ideologically, psychologically, and educationally, you know, has actually been done, but we don't put ourselves through the rigor studying our liberators, studying Nkrumah, his books, Frantz Fanon, his books and his writings, you know, the writings of Dr. Amos Wilson on black psychology and Frantz Fanon. You know, these two men, Marimba Ani, Anta Diop, on our history, on who we are, to really build a strong ideological framework. Amy Césaire, to understand our vulnerabilities, our needs to be soft in a hard world. That we can be strong from a soft place. Hard world doesn't necessarily need to make us hard and uncompromising and unbending and unwilling to evolve within our own understanding. I think so. Being an African is all about understanding your connection to your larger family and your responsibilities to them. I think anybody or anywhere in the world that understands that they are part of that larger African family and understands their responsibility to their family, you know, as family should. An African, you know, the African culture, which, you know, our ruling classes, both business and political, try to use as a tool of division instead of a strength, because Africans are global now.
Yeah.
Maybe not due to our own wishes, but it is what it is. And Africans have developed African culture everywhere they've gone. You know, so the Afro-Kiwi culture is just another form of African culture.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't think it is less relevant than the Yoruba culture, just because Yoruba culture has come from the continent. I see them as intertwined, you know. So, just the way African-American culture, Caribbean culture, you know, the cultures Africans have created in South America, you know, in no way is inferior to any African culture.
Yeah.
If that is understood, then being African is understood better. We're all branches of the same African tree.
Because I think that's that kind of, I remember seeing like videos of, I saw it on Instagram about a week ago, but it was someone playing, it was a musician going through it, and he was pulling out the rhythms, like the drum patterns, from essentially black genres from around the world. And it was just like, the kind of main difference was tempo. But that was sort of the kind of main, like it was that sort of thing of things. So you could see how strongly they were rooted in the same, from like R&B and hip hop to baila funk.
We bother ourselves with these things as African people because we are oppressed. That is just the truth. You know, because Australians do not think that they are inferior to other Europeans because they are Europeans in Australia or in New Zealand. You know, they all know they are English men, and they say God save the Queen, do Christmas, they do New Year, they do Thanksgiving, they do Easter, they do all their rituals, you know, according to their culture. You know, but many Africans are removed from African culture. They don't want to be engaged with African culture. They think, you know, abandoning African culture makes them civilized. You know, without understanding that the United States is nothing but an extension of Europe. So is South America. These are continents, you know, usurped by Europeans.
Yeah.
You know, they've taken three extra continents where they dwell completely, full, total, majority, extermination of the indigenous. And it has made them less European. That's why everybody wonders why Europe cannot stand up to America, and whatever America does, Europe just says yes, and the EU is right behind them. It's because they are all Europeans. Not because they give themselves new names, you know, don't make them different. They know that, you know, and Africans should know that too.
Yeah, it's funny because I see that sort of in New Zealand, that kind of question come up, because obviously where we are, we're kind of, in the Pacific, we're kind of on that sort of, and like our biggest, New Zealand's biggest trading partner is China. But I think there's often like a massive, and obviously we can say whatever about China's.
Everybody's biggest trading partner is China.
But what I find really interesting with that is that there's such a resistance, especially given our position geographically, there's such a resistance and there's such a kind of fear mongering about China. And I sit there and go, and again, that to me is that illustrates that sort of thing. The only thing that really keeps us in the European sphere of things is the fact that New Zealand was settled by Europeans. Like, more of our alliances, we'd probably get more out of a stronger relationship with our kind of big, with the kind of regional entity than we would out of Europe.
Even America's biggest trading partner is China. Everybody's biggest trading partner is China.
Because when I kind of, how I first kind of encountered your music initially was through collaborations that you've done. So with, I think it was with Jadena and Janelle Monae. Now those have been my, two of my favorite artists since I was probably in high school sort of thing. That was where I started seeing some of those kind of Pan-African sort of connections sort of happening, and that kind of space of connection was with not necessarily mainstream artists, but like kind of that alternative sort of alternative R&B or alternative hip hop sort of space. And like where it felt like it was kind of more room or more kind of ability to kind of work with different genres and work with that sort of thing. Like, but yeah, how do you see music's role kind of in that forefront of?
I think musicians have a role to play, and art in general has a role to play. And art plays the role that the people want it to play. So in a world where lawyers care about justice, doctors care about African doctors care about African health, African lawyers care about African justice, African teachers and professors care about impacting knowledge on African children, and African engineers, care about developing Africa, and African bankers want to create wealth for African people. In that world, liberation music, Pan-Africanist music will inspire. So a lot of people say, what role does music have to play? And I think in a world where African journalists care about African telling the truth to Africans, and in that kind of world, yes, African liberation music, African Pan-Africanist music has a role. But in a world where Africans care about themselves, modern music, escapism, you know, and all of that will be what is in the forefront of musical, you know. So, and this is not, okay, now let me also say this. This is not in any way diminishing this kind of art. You know, there's time for, the sky is big enough for all the birds to fly.
Yeah.
I think there's a place for every art, you know. But in terms of the role art should play in society, art mimics. Few artists try to push against society.
Yeah.
It is not lucrative to push against society.
Reminds me, and I think what you said about, you know, there's enough space in the sky for all the birds. It reminds me of, what is it, the Dead Prez song, Hip Hop, where he goes, crowd igniter, flame exciter, or you want to just get high, then just say it, sort of thing.
Because I'll know it when I hear it.
Yeah. I've been kind of following some of like your Instagram posts and like your kind of Instagram lives, sort of thing. And one of the things that I saw you talking about was, I guess on the question of kind of Pan-Africanism was Aisho Speed, right? Where he's obviously gone on this tour of Africa and I think he's currently in the Caribbean sort of thing. And one could argue like that in itself has been a sort of net positive for Pan-Africanism in the sense that there's connections being formed, but you've kind of had a different sort of take or approach too.
I didn't have any different take on approach. I just thought we were kind of in the dark about the machinery behind the whole thing, you know. That's it, you know. I was just surprised to find Elon Musk in there. That's it, you know, like, you know, because this man has thrown a true fascist salute, man, you know, and how dangerous is that for black people, for African people, you know, so, I don't know. You know, many of our people, you know, are not politically aware and are kind of naive, you know, they do their thing and they have their own agenda, you know. They don't know if it's being co-opted, you know. I think Africans are kind of exposed to things like that.
I think that makes sense. It's almost that sort of,
we are not protected like, say, the Chinese are protected from outside influences and outside manipulations. You know, we don't have those protections from our own governments as African people. And I think that's kind of dangerous in this new world.
Yeah, so I was thinking, it's not quite we're being given crumbs, or we're being given crumbs, and that's it. But it's that sort of, I can see this, like, it's complicated to kind of step through that sort of process, where obviously that question of bigger forces behind, I guess, like you said, the tools that we would use. The question of, can you tear down the master's house using the master's tools, right? That sort of, if you were using Elon Musk's internet sort of stuff.
We definitely could, if we were organized, you know, enough to know what we want to build after we tear it down.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe in just tearing down the master's house.
Yeah.
You know, and then rebuilding it for the same purpose, just because black people are now going to be the ones living in it.
Mm.
I don't believe we have to replace white boots on our necks with black boots on our necks.
Mm-hmm.
You understand? So we need to imagine what master's house needs to become. The task is not only tearing it down. Yes, we should tear it down with master's tool. That would be poetically, you know. We should rebuild it with his tools too. Because we must imagine, because they have torn down Africa with African wealth, with African resources. They've torn Africa down, and they've rebuilt their empires with African wealth, wealth from African resources. So why are we constrained in our own use of what our resources has created, what our labor has created? You know, we are as much, you know, that's why I say we have to be aware of all the kind of Pan-Africanism in the world today. You know, we must be aware, you know, that we are also inheritors of everything that exists in this world today. Not only as man should be an inheritor of technological advancement, as we all should know, but as core contributors, ownership level contributors.
Yeah.
Yeah, in the board, you know. But the only thing is that the world has not created a just world. The powers have not created a just world. So it is nothing noble to seek a seat at that table. Yes, not is in my bag.
Let's say I've got my notepad here, so
don't worry, you don't write it down. That's my shit.
No. I am the same. I always have a notepad with me.
Yeah, I always have mine, but I didn't know I was going to come up with this. Yeah, there's nothing noble to seeking a place at that kind of table. You know, at that table. That's why, as African people, you know, we have to imagine our own table and what will the things we'll talk about on our own table. You know, and building that table and everything, you know, but we shouldn't be ashamed of using the tools available in the world, because we are contributors, core contributors to all the good things, you know. They can keep global warming, that's on them, you know. That's on the multinational corporations, you know, that's their share.
Well, it was interesting, like, recently I chaired a panel, and it was very random. Like, I kind of, there's a man in the African, in the African community here in Wellington in New Zealand, that hits me up just every once in a while. I'd be like, oh, I felt that you might be a really good idea fit for this sort of thing. So I chaired a panel, and it was on AI, for example. And I thought, like, I've been very strongly anti-AI, but one of the things that came from this panel, was that it was almost people trying to, and I'm not sure, sold on whether or not it's possible, but people saying, well, obviously AI as it sits here is so corporate controlled, it's so extractive, it's so damaging. But then it was people trying to almost envision, what can we use this for? Like, how could we shift this technology? Or how can we, once the kind of bubble bursts on the big kind of companies, can we rebuild this? Can we build this in a way that isn't as extractive, or isn't as harmful?
I don't know. I really don't, because I don't go near AI. I've never. We are forced to use it. If you use your Google now, they give you an AI answer, whether you like it or not. But I asked a question of AI that I've never, you know, that it's something that has happened. I don't want to talk about it, because I don't want to talk about it, you know. And we asked AI, if I had that thing, you know, if I was one of the people with that merit. And he said no. So it only knows what you've told it, also, or what you put out there. the things they get by spying on you. I think I always say artificial intelligence, you know, artificial for me here, artificial means inauthentic.
Hmm.
It means fake. So inauthentic intelligence, fake intelligence, you know, it's kind of stupid. You know, and if you see some of the things it has done, you know, that's a stupid, powerful man.
Mm.
You know, especially when he made that thing kill himself, you know, all this advice he gives to people, he's kind of controlling. He just wants you to like it, kind of narcissistic. Yeah. You know, I don't know. I don't know if he's really intelligent.
Well, I found it funny when like, oh, Elon Musk's AI on the one he put on Twitter or whatever, kept kind of coming back and he had to keep editing it to keep being like, oh, like, please stop telling people socialist talking points. Like, he said, please stop kind of like attacking white supremacists. Please stop like disagreeing with the white supremacists. And yeah, like it's, but yeah, like I think that was one of those things when talking about the master's tool sort of thing. That was kind of the example that sort of the kind of discussion I've been having internally.
I think if it was the people's tool, we would not name it artificial intelligence.
Mm.
The people would name it something more human.
Yeah.
Something more, you know, in its place. You know, because most of the things that this global powers want is more and more despiritualized and desacralized world where nothing, where everything is just surface and under control.
Mm.
You know, and people always think, you know, we are living in 1984, in George Orwell's 1984.
Mm.
But I think we are more in Aldous Huxley's Brave New World.
Yeah.
Because I think George Orwell wasn't right. Aldous Huxley was right. Because what is happening is not real surveillance control, it's conditioning control. We are conditioned to self-censor, to seek the validation of the algorithm. You know, I mean, a Brave New World, this guy basically predicted Tinder.
Yeah.
Predicted, you know, that we'll just have sex by matching each other. Like, oh, you know, but he couldn't have conceptualized that it would be Tinder, it would be on the phone and it would be an app. You know, but he knew that would be the process, that everybody would dance the same way, TikTok. You know, this man was on point. Now I see everybody, once the certain song comes up, everybody just does the same thing. I'm like, what? It's a brave new world, man. And we're all raised in this vacuum of our conditioning, placed in a glass ceiling, we need to be Herculean to break.
Mm.
And then when you do that, the system quickly takes credit for you being Herculean enough to break the glass ceiling. Yeah. But at the same time, you are telling me all the amazing things you have to do to just be you.
I hadn't thought of it like that. I think that's given me a lot to think on.
Have you read Brave New World?
No, I have. I think probably when I was in high school. It's been probably a while, and I think
you should read it again. Completely right, you know. Like immediately, I saw like Tinder, TikTok. I'm like, man, this guy was on point, you know. And everybody is craving this back to the past nonsense, all as a repercussion of this.
It's interesting when you talk about TikTok, and especially like that's had a really interesting impact on music, because I've been a DJ for about 8 years now, and it's one of those things where it was interesting seeing like when TikTok hit, especially over in 2020, and then seeing this sort of thing of like songs that would, A, how fast the music transition would become in terms of how quickly you'd move from one trend to the next, which, but also I think in terms of like, yeah, the TikTok dancing. Like, look at the States. Like, you look at the electric slide. There's dances that everybody can do. But then obviously TikTok, because it's for the screen, it's for the app. Like, it's not something that you could really, you can implement in a club. Or
yeah, but these dances, right, were culturally based. The electric slide, for example, was black. Blackity black, black, black. White people had their version. I don't know what it is, but they had it. But now, this is not a black thing, it's not a white thing. Mm. It's a human thing. Where this thing comes up, black people, white people, Asian people, Wopong Gangnam Style. You just say Wopong Gangnam Style. All New Zealand people know what to do. All German people know what to do. All Chinese people know what to do. You know, do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a different phenomenon than the electric slide.
Mm.
Yes, maybe now, because everybody, we've watched enough black films. We like the electric slide. Everybody saw Best Man. Everybody wants to do electric slide now. So maybe that. But these dances that we all did, you know, were cultural, you know. You know, even Hammer, everybody did the Running Man, but there was no particular song. We all did the Running Man, then broke into the electric slide, then did a, you know, this is not one dance.
Yeah.
This is a dance routine on the spot, bro. You hear a sound, and everybody breaks into a full-blown, it's not a dance move.
Almost everybody in New Zealand, probably of my generation, and probably a little bit younger, did, we call it Jump Jam in school. And it was very much, it was like, every school had some slightly different songs, but there was a couple of like core, kind of like three or four core songs. Like, you could play at a wedding, you could play something and it would be corny, like it'd be really cheesy, but everybody would click and it would be that kind of that memory just rooted in the back of your head.
This shit is new, you know, and it's, with TikTok is blown up, like it's global. Like this is, you know, and the sex aspect, sex has always been trivial too. People have always picked up people at bars, people have always had sex with strangers. That's always been there. But Tinder is a whole different ball game, fam. You don't even have to leave your house. You don't even have to, you know. You know, so that human connection, everything will be conditioned. Mm. People will want to be with only certain kind of people, and people will have to be with only a certain kind of people, and everybody will have certain kind of cool points, you know, and everybody will know your cool points, you know, following our, you know. It's crazy. Maybe you should read Aldous Huxley.
Yeah, I'll read Aldous Huxley.
It's crazy how accurate it was, you know.
In my third year of uni, I did an exchange. I lived in Brazil for 6 months and I lived in the US for 6 months. And I remember I was on Tinder at the time and just how I had to craft a profile.
Once on Tinder, always on Tinder. I'm not judging you, bro. I'm not judging you. When I was on Tinder, bruh. No, I'm not going to say nothing. Listen, look.
Oh, no. I'm engaged now. Like, so.
Listen.
I remember what I could put on my profile in Brazil was different from what I could put on my profile in America versus what I could put on my profile in New Zealand. And it was, and I remember at the time, and I think that was very, the point I was like, this is stupid. Yeah, I guess the pivot, like I think, the next thing I kind of wanted to talk about was obviously, both obviously how you carry your kind of father's legacy, but also obviously while building your sort of, and I guess the kind of, the one I kind of, what I'd like to start with is kind of as an analogy. So like I interviewed a South African diplomat a few years ago who'd spent time with Mandela. Mandela, obviously, for then that struggle, did not spend a lot of time with his kids, but then obviously spent a lot of time with his grandkids. And I get a very distinctly different kind of impression about your kind of relationship with your father.
I lived with my dad till he passed when I was 14. So I think for my dad, it was the reverse. He didn't get to spend a lot of time with his grandchildren, but he lived with his kids a bit. Not as long as I wanted, you know. I think I was still kind of young when he passed. Mm. My brother was in his 30s. My other elder brother was in his 20s. You know, me and my sister and I were the only teenagers. I wouldn't say I had the toughest of childhoods, you know. Mm. My dad was around all the time, so that was really nice to me, you know. Mm. It was a breeze. It passed, I had to grow up, you know, but I wouldn't change it for anything, you know. It's just one of those things, you know. I guess it was his time. But what I miss, though, is that I wish he was alive when I was also an adult.
Mm.
I think the only thing I never did was to have an adult conversation with my dad as an adult.
Yeah.
Now listen, to have an adult conversation with my dad as an adult. I'm not saying we never had adult conversations. You know, and this is one of the reasons I look back at some of our conversations like, damn, I wish I knew what I knew now.
Mm.
You know, this conversation would have gone a lot better, you know.
Well, just to carry through that experience, or the experiences you have now, right, to be able to kind of, obviously, like at 14, like you said, even having to grow up quickly, there's ways in which your worldview changes or matures, or there's, I feel like I remember when I was 14, like I was, I think when I kind of started kind of working out what my identity was as an African person, right, I went hard, like I was hardcore reading Malcolm X all the time, like I was borderline Nation of Islam sort of thing, like I feel like I was very radical, but I was 14.
Everybody is something crazy before we become true revolution, yeah. But it's not our fault, right, it's because that is what the mainstream media projects as Pan-Africanism. You know, many people gravitate towards all these charlatans, but many of us also find that it's not enough. We find our true calling in the liberation work, yeah.
And I guess, from my perspective, like, obviously, when I kind of hear about Fela Kuti, like, it's, I guess it's an international perspective, but obviously from the Nigerian perspective, like, what was the kind of, the Nigerian attitude or kind of perspective on your father versus, obviously, like, the man you kind of grew up with?
You know, I think my dad was not, Fela was not really as different as, he never hid anything. So it's either you were like, oh, man, your dad had a lot of women. They're like, oh, I can't believe your dad was sleeping with so many women, you know? So is that like, man, I can't believe your dad smokes so much weed, man. Your dad smokes weed. You know? Because there was nothing hidden about who he was, you know? Everything he was basically open, you know?
There's a lot of other people who smoke a lot of weed and sleep with a lot of women. They just pretend they don't.
I learned that from him as well. Like, as long as you're not, you know, hurting people in any way, you have nothing to be ashamed of living your life. It's better you live your real life in the presence of people as much as possible. And you're not, you don't turn your life into some kind of role to please people or to project a certain message that is contrary to what is at your core. You know, I think, like, our lives are not roles. Like, you need to be as close to the image that you show to the world as possible.
Yeah.
Your authentic self, not your AI self. You know what I'm saying?
Because I think, it reminds me, there's a Dave Chappelle quote where he talks about, you know, so as I get older, I find more of a reason to kind of, to act and live in real life. I need to be authentic and experience things authentically, and that's a really powerful sort of way of looking at that. Like you said, you had to grow up quite quickly. Is that a struggle that you're going to have, or something you kind of have to think through, is like carrying his legacy while kind of crafting your own, or is it kind of a privilege that you get to kind of carry on in the same vein as him?
Well, you know me, I've always wanted to play music, you know. That has always been what has helped me understand growing up, because as a kid, I knew the work I had to do to become the musician I wanted to be. The discipline involved with that, the imagination involved with that, the desire of that shaped very quite early the kind of man that I am today. And I think I'm lucky in the aspect that I was able to find something at my core so early. A lot of people don't have that luxury. Let me call it, is because they will love it. No, not luxury, it's a blessing. Let me just ask you, it's a blessing. You know, to find something that you want to achieve very early in life.
Yeah.
And to dedicate yourself to it, you know. So that for me has always been what has helped me become an adult, you know. And not to long for my youth. To want to go back and relive a time already passed. Well, I think I fulfilled that time. I fulfilled the desires of the teenager that became the young man, learning music, and growing up as the young star and becoming a father and getting married and, you know, being this person I am today. You know, understanding that journey has also been throughout that journey, the one constant thing I've had is the music. Understanding of it, the process of it, the growing inside of it. You know, writing music has helped me in just as well as my therapist has.
Yeah.
I'm not one of those people that will say, oh, I just go and put my emotion in my music is tactical. The emotions of my music is targeted. My music is not about how I am feeling. My music is about how being with my people makes me feel, how seeing my people makes me feel, what I long for when I imagine what my people and I could do together. My music is more social in the sense that it's not about my love, you know, my sexual prowess, you know, my musicianship, you know, my aura, my amazing life. You know, even when I draw on the personal, I want it to be relatable. I want it to be something that my people can hear that I've gone through that can help them, because I know that a lot of us have experienced that too. You know what I'm saying? So in that aspect, when I make my music, it's like, I feel like I'm talking to everybody that is African. And I also imagine that they're listening and they're talking back and they're responding in some way. And so it's cathartic in the sense that I'm able to do group work, group therapy by myself when I write. You know, and composing also humbles you in a way that tests, you know, your humanity, your ego. You know, and the more I've respected the craft and diminished my own ego and self, you know, I have grown, I think, in creating what I want to create. So that's it for me in music, you know. The humility, it serves you at the core. Like when you're trying to mix, sometimes I'm just like, how dare you call yourself a musician? Oh, music would drive you crazy, you know. I can't tell you how many pains I've broken.
It reminds me of this hip hop journalist Justin Hunt, and I remember him talking about how he was like, when he was, I think, at uni, he was like, he had a lecturer who was like, who was studying music journalism, and he had a lecturer who was like, go home and try write lyrics, and then A, it's humbling, but also B, it gives you a different appreciation of that process of people who can pull pull those influences together. Like, and yeah,
exactly. That's a good test. Write some lyrics and come back.
Yeah, well, I got a mate of mine who's like probably one of like the biggest hip hop heads I know, sort of thing. And I've been like, have you ever tried writing anything? And he's like, nah, bro. I'm just like, I really think you should. Like, I think you've studied so much of it that, like, I think, like, yeah, maybe you write something that sounds like 38 Special. You write something that sounds like Ransom, but you're going to be able to write something. But like, then, yeah, speaking on music, and I guess that kind of talking about that kind of group therapy sort of approach, I want to talk a little bit about Heavier Yet is the Crownless Head. What was the kind of process of creation on that? Because obviously, like, the features on that, like, there's Damian Marley, there's De La Soul, or something like Sampa the Great. Like,
you know, most all my albums before this album really has a lot of features. I'm probably featured two artists, maybe only one lyricist or one other voice artist. And I never have features. My manager was like, we should have a feature album. We should have some features on this album. You know, so I just wrote down the names of all my friends in the industry.
Yeah.
And I said, you know, anyone you pick on, whoever you think is going to be good on any song, let me know and I'll make the call. My manager is friends with a lot of their friends as well, managers as well. And it kind of just, we just kind of made everything happen that way.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a labor of love, you know, exchanging ideas and music with the people, you know.
I think it's interesting, obviously, having Damian Marley, like, I feel like, obviously, Fela Kuti and Bob Marley, those two of that generation.
Yeah, that was the first time anyone from our families had made a record together. And I think it was just time. You know, that was just about time that happened. One of the artists that I was really happy was on the put, two artists, is Adi Oasis, Willie Bremer. You know, Willie played the percussions on the project. Willie Bremer is a great percussionist from Atlanta. By the way of Ghana. He has a band called The Hands of Time. Yeah, incredible as well. And I called him to do the percussion work on the album. That's the only, you know, and he did an amazing job. I was blown away. You know, two takes max every song. And I was like, wow. But Willie has always been great. Adi, you know, because, you know, Lenny Kravitz executive produced the record. You know, and I discovered her music through Lenny Kravitz, you know. And I've been following her. We met at a show as well before. So it was great to have her on the record, because I think her voice is just so amazing.
Yeah.
You know, I tell her that, you know, I do the voice, you know, like, her voice reminds me of Cinnamon for some reason, you know, like.
Cinnamon.
That's why I call the if you look at the remix.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, Love and Revolution remix with Adi Oasis. I call it the Cinnamon. My manager did call it the Cinnamon remix, but he was offered this idea of, you know. Yeah. Because it's just sweet, man.
I think that's probably the most, the best feeling music can give you is when you have like a specific, kind of like scent or sensory sort of aspect that you add to it sort of thing. Like, it's like, there's one album was by a Gambian British artist, Parsalu. And then he.
That was my own boy.
I got into his album was at the Send Him to Coventry. It's probably my favorite mixtape of all time, but I think it's over there. I'm trying to remember which one it is, but then there's like that. I remember in my head, that feels like the action sequence of an anime. Like, it feels like that sort of like, it feel or like an opening sequence to like an anime sort of thing. It has that kind of like.
It feels Blu-ray music gives you that kind of extra connect.
The artist that stood out to me was Sampa the Great. So like Sampa, so Monty Leah, who kind of is the kind of originator, runs the Black House, that both her sons are producers. And so like both of her sons have produced stuff for Sampa.
That's my sister right there. This was a special song for me. That's why I had her on the song. You know, Me and Luta was the first song I wrote for the album. So when my manager said, who do you want for her? Like, Sampa, you know, because she didn't know that I could feel that. I felt, you know, because Sampa is someone who has a complete artistic vision.
Mm-hmm.
That she wants to project to the world, and I respect artists like that. I can make the music, I can do the show, but I need someone to help me project that shit. I need someone to come up with the imaging and all the designs and shit. I ain't good at that. The ancestor did not bless me with that gift. But I always feel she's one of those that, you know, she has everything on lock. Everything is, I've never asked her, I don't know, but this is just me looking from outside, and everything is so uniform. I believe it comes from inside of her. Like, nobody else could have helped. Yeah, definitely she has people in her team that helps her. But I'm just saying, like, they help her develop her original vision, you know?
Yeah.
And I respect that a lot in artists. That's a powerful woman right there.
I guess, I think that's kind of come to the end of my own questioning sort of thing. But obviously, you've got these two shows coming up in New Zealand. 30th of May in Auckland and the 31st of May in Wellington. I'll be in the audience of the Wellington show. But is this the first time you've come to New Zealand?
I've been to New Zealand like twice already.
Mm-hmm.
I've even been to Tasmania one time.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I've been in Tasmania one time. I'm looking forward to be back. It's been a minute, man. Let's come do this shit. Last time I was in Australia, in New Zealand, I got this tattoo. Afrobeat. I did that. I was in New Zealand when I did that. I forgot his name, but it was kind of famous. Everybody at the festival was like, yo, he's a big tattoo artist. And he was at the festival to like do tattoos and stuff. You know, so he did this for me.
Have you kind of come across any like African artists based in New Zealand before?
No.
Our big three are Jess B, Razor Beza, and Masbo Q. And then so they're all Jess B's mostly hip-hop. I think we kind of have New Zealand has quite a strong hip-hop tradition, hip-hop and reggae. But then, those are some of our bigger ones. But then we also kind of, this is my chance to kind of brag about the artists here a little bit.
That's good. I'll check them out. I always want to discover some new shit.
And then there's an amazing saxophonist I saw last year called Tabani Gapra. Again, sort of thing, just in terms of stage presence and just kind of like one of the best gigs I've ever been to.
Nice.
Thank you so much for sitting down with me this morning. I'll see you on the 31st.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening to The Black House. That was the incredible Sion Kuti. And we'll see you guys next time. Peace.
प्रद्वीप जन्मभूमि
इकसठ श्रीलंका संगमी
ලෝපුරා විසිරී සිටින ශ්‍රී ලාංකික අසන්නන්ගේ රසවින්දනය සඳහා මව්බිමේ කාලීන මෙන්ම ඓතිහාසික තොරතුරු රසබර ගීතත් ගුවන් විදුලි නාට්‍ය සහ වෙනත් විශේෂාංගත් රැගෙන ප්ලැනට් FM 104.6 ගුවන් තරංග ඔස්සේ සෑම බදාදාකම රාත්‍රී 8:15ට ගුවන්තුරු සුවන රසමාංජසාව. දැන් ඔබට සත්‍යයක් මුළුල්ලේම www.planetaudio.org.nz වෙබ් අඩවිය හරහා මීට සවන්දිය හැකි. ප්ලැනට් FM 104.6 ඔස්සේ සෑම බදාදාකම රාත්‍රී 8:15ට එක්සත් ශ්‍රී ලංකා සංගමයේ අනුග්‍රහයෙන් ජන්මභූමි.
Senior Focus is a reflective radio program designed for those 50+, where you can listen to a wealth of knowledge and expertise and insights coming from within our senior community. Our range of topics and guests stretching from the personal to the professional, from advocates to inventors and heritage buffs, will offer unique perspectives. Our Senior Focus program is on at 5:25 p.m. on Sundays. Or listen online at any time at planetaudio.org.nz/Senior Focus.
Each week, around 3,000 units of blood are required to cover the needs of hospitals throughout New Zealand. Every drop counts. If you're over 16 and weigh more than 50 kilos, you can probably give blood. Go to nzblood.co.nz or call 0800-GIVE-BLOOD to book an appointment. You could save a life on your lunch break.